Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we have news from Washington, D.C. that Secretary of State John Kerry has declared atrocities committed by ISIS against religious minorities to be genocide, an effort that started right here in our own local Iraqi Chaldean community, including early interviews on our radio show. Then on Green Scene, learn about a bill in Sacramento to protect oak forests in California, and Here's the Buzz, a second measure that would protect bees from harmful pesticides. San Diego will be feeling the burn this Tuesday when presidential candidate Bernie Sanders comes to town for a rally downtown, and we'll have details. Then on our Capitol Report, we'll have news about President Barack Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, and why Republicans are refusing to allow a hearing for Judge Merrick Garland, even though they previously supported him. The National Weather Service is looking for volunteers to help measure rainfall and snow in our region, and we'll tell you how you can get involved. From Public News Service, we'll tell you about a shortage of staff at community clinics and the impact that is having. And then on the second half of our show, our newsmaker interview is with our very own publisher, Mark Hansen, head of the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We'll tell you about some big awards Heartland recently won in recognition of their programs helping minorities and others, providing education and jobs training for people in need. And we'll end by re-airing one of our Best of East County segments, a Sounds of History interview with Ken Woodward, the curator of the Guy B. Woodward Museum in Ramona, on Ramona's colorful past. So stay tuned for these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with some major news from Washington, D.C. that's welcome among Iraqis here in San Diego's East County, which has the second highest Iraqi Chaldean population in the United States. Since 2014, local Iraqi Chaldean leaders have been speaking out and urging the U.S. to take action to halt what they termed genocide committed by ISIS, also known as ISIL or Daesh, against religious minorities including Christians, Yazidis, and others. On Thursday, Secretary of State John Kerry made a formal declaration that ISIS or Daesh has committed genocide against religious minorities in the Middle East.
My purpose in appearing before you today is to assert that in my judgment, Daesh is responsible for genocide against groups in areas under its control, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shia Muslims. Daesh is genocidal by self-proclamation, by ideology, and by actions in what it says, what it believes, and what it does. Daesh is also responsible for crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing directed at these same groups and in some cases also against Sunni Muslims, Kurds, and other minorities.
Now, our show here on KNSJ was the first to interview Marco Rabo, a leader in the Iraqi Chaldean community locally, when he first called for a genocide declaration back in 2014. After our interview, Rabo was interviewed by national media outlets and ultimately held meetings with President Barack Obama, Secretary of State John Kerry, and the United Nations. Here's an excerpt from one of our interviews with Marco Rabo in mid-2014.
There are more and more killings. Images of mass executions are coming out of Tikrit, and once it was home to many Chaldean families. And now Sunnis are actually beginning to fight alongside with ISIS. And the reason is because from the onset, the Maliki government, they didn't allow the Ba'ath Party to participate in elections, which caused a deep-rooted resentment between the Shiites and the Sunnis. And for the Chaldean community at large throughout America, this is a living nightmare that won't go away. And we organized as a community, and we did a petition online. We've talked to our members of Congress. We talked to all the delegates in San Diego. We've spoken to our U.S. senators here and in Michigan. And we're doing everything we can. We're talking to the State Department as well. And we spoke to President Obama to say that we need to find a way for UN and NATO to come together and support a mass exodus of Christians and Chaldeans out of Iraq, and a safe passage to other countries around the world, because there is no safe haven in Iraq. And no question about it, this is a slow genocide.
Today, Arabo heads up the Minority Humanitarian Foundation, and he welcomed news of Secretary Kerry's genocide declaration this week. Arabo said he learned of Secretary Kerry's action in a phone call from David Saperstein, the U.S. Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom, early Thursday morning. Arabo says, "I picked up the phone and immediately he told me that our organization had made it happen." Arabo calls Secretary Kerry's action a monumental step forward, adding, "Now we will begin the long road to recovery." He says the next step for the Minority Humanitarian Foundation will be to introduce comprehensive legislation to protect and serve displaced Christians throughout the region. Kerry's formal designation comes days after the House of Representatives passed a resolution unanimously condemning ISIS atrocities as genocide and asking the State Department to issue a declaration. Kerry says it's important to recognize what Daesh or ISIS is doing to its victims, though what is essential is to stop them, he added. He listed atrocities committed by Sunni Muslim extremists against Christians, Yazidis, Kurds, Shiite Muslims, and others because of their faith. ISIS has slaughtered Christians, forcing millions to flee their homes or convert to ISIS' extreme version of Islam. ISIS fighters have also captured, raped, and enslaved thousands of Yazidi women and girls, destroying entire cities, towns, and religious symbols such as churches and ancient heritage sites. Secretary Kerry offered hope, speaking of the progress that the U.S. and its allies have made in pushing back against ISIS or Daesh.
In 2014... the terrorist group Daesh began to seize territory in Syria and Iraq, overrunning major cities and committing atrocities. The United States responded quickly by denouncing these horrific acts and, more importantly, taking coordinated actions to counter them. In September of that year, President Obama mobilized an international coalition, now 66 members strong, to halt and reverse Daesh's momentum. And that is what we are doing. In the 18 months since, coalition airstrikes have helped to liberate Kobani, Tikrit, Ramadi, and other key cities and towns. We have pushed the terrorists out of 40% of the territory that they once controlled in Iraq and 20% in Syria. We have degraded their leadership, attacked their revenue sources, and disrupted their supply lines. And currently, we are engaged, as you all know, in a diplomatic initiative aimed at trying to end the war in Syria. That civil war fuels Daesh, and in doing what we are doing now, we are working to further isolate, to weaken, and ultimately to defeat them. We are working intensively to stop the spread of Daesh and its affiliates within and beyond the region. All of this constitutes an extraordinary effort by a large segment of the international community and the United States. And that effort is fully warranted by the appalling actions of the organization that we oppose.
The genocide declaration carries with it ethical and legal questions. A key issue will be whether the designation obligates the U.S. to take action to stop the genocide. One likely step would be a referral to the United Nations Security Council to prosecute war crimes and crimes against humanity under the International Criminal Court or another tribunal set up for Iraq and Syria. In his concluding remarks, Secretary Kerry offered these observations.
Our purpose is to marginalize and defeat violent extremists once and for all. Now, that is not easy. We know that. As President Obama and I have consistently said, it won't happen overnight. But today I say to all our fellow citizens and to the international community, we must recognize what Daesh is doing to its victims. We must hold the perpetrators accountable, and we must find the resources to help those harmed by these atrocities be able to survive on their ancestral land. Naming these crimes is important. But what is essential is to stop. That will require unity in this country and within the countries directly involved. And the determination to act against genocide, against ethnic cleansing, against the other crimes against humanity must be pronounced among decent people all across the globe. Thank you.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with the Green Scene Report. Insect infestations and drought have killed off thousands of oak trees in San Diego County and even more statewide. Now Assembly Bill 2162, the Oak Woodlands Protection Bill, has been introduced into the California legislature by Assemblyman Kenson Chu. The measure seeks to protect old-growth oak forests and prevent the massive conversion of oak woodlands to urban, suburban, and agricultural uses. It would create an Oak Woodlands Protection Fund. Permits would be required for oak tree removal, with permit fees paid into the fund so that no allocation of state revenues would be required. Permits could be denied if an oak is close to waterways or if oak removal would result in destruction of over 10% of the forest canopy that existed before January 1, 2015. The law is well-intentioned given the vast destruction of oak forests through the gold-spotted oak boring beetle and other predators, as well as drought, climate change, wildfires, and development in rural areas. But the current language raises some concerns. The measure does not appear to have an exception to the 10% rule to allow broader removal of trees in areas with heavy infestation of oak boring beetles that kill trees, even if doing so could save other trees from destruction. The measure also does not spell out the fee costs or whether those could pose a substantial financial burden to existing landowners in rural areas with large properties hard hit by infestations or trees killed by drought. The law would not apply to oak removal for creation of fire breaks, fuel removal, or right of ways. Removing a protected oak tree without a permit could result in a $25,000 fine for each violation.
A new bill aims to slow the collapse of bee colonies by making certain pesticides available only to trained professionals and by requiring labels on seeds and plants sold in nurseries that are treated with the toxic chemicals. Senate Bill 1282, the Pollinator Protection Act, was introduced recently in the state Senate and would regulate pesticides in a class called neonicotinoids. Paul Towers with the advocacy group Be Smart California says everyone has an interest in protecting bees.
Bees are responsible for 1 in 3 bites of food that we eat, and they are in precipitous decline. In fact, the last year on record, over 40% of California's honeybees died.
In January, the EPA put out a risk assessment of one of the pesticides called imidacloprid that said it is harmful to bees and may need to be regulated. Bayer, the company that makes these pesticides, including a rose and shrub spray commonly sold in garden stores, said that neonicotinoids are critical to protect agriculture from pests and are much safer than pesticides used in the past. Towers says surveys show that up to half of the bee-friendly plants purchased at garden centers have levels of pesticides high enough to injure or kill bees.
We need to give consumers the right information about the plants that they're purchasing so they don't mistakenly purchase something bee-friendly and, in fact, do more harm than good.
There have been similar efforts on a federal level. Last year, Representative John Conyers of Michigan introduced a bill called the Saving America's Pollinators Act of 2015, but it has stalled in the House Committee on Agriculture. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
San Diegans will be feeling the burn this week as Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders arrives for a Future to Believe In rally on Tuesday, March 22nd at the San Diego Convention Center. The doors open at 5 p.m. and early arrivals and RSVPs are suggested because Sanders has been drawing huge crowds recently, including about 17,000 in Salt Lake City and lines of supporters over 2 miles long in Michigan. Sanders has won primaries or caucuses in 9 states so far. He trails Hillary Clinton in overall delegates, but some predict he could sweep western states, including California, which has the most delegates of any state in the nation, to remain a viable contender. Running on a populist platform, Vermont Senator Sanders has long been a vocal advocate for economic justice, denouncing the growing income gap between billionaires and ordinary working Americans. He has called for a massive investment in infrastructure projects to put Americans to work, voted against the Bush bailout of big banks, and against the first Gulf War. He supports universal health care, free college education, and has laid out his strategies to pay for those proposals largely through increasing taxes on the wealthy. He aims to stop corporations from outsourcing jobs overseas and has also sponsored a major bill to combat global warming. Now, if you are planning on attending the rally, for security reasons, a few things you should know. Don't bring bags, and limit what you bring to small personal items like keys and cell phones. Weapons, sharp objects, chairs, signs, and banners on sticks will not be allowed through security. You can park in a garage for an on-site fee, and carpooling is strongly encouraged, or you can take the trolley, which stops directly in front of the convention center. For more information, you can Google the Bernie Sanders campaign, and to read more about his candidacy, you can check out the politics section at eastcountymagazine.org. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. To fill the vacancy left on the Supreme Court by the death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia, President Barack Obama has nominated Merrick Garland, a judicial moderate supported overwhelmingly by both Republicans and Democrats when he was appointed to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia back in 1997. But in a move unprecedented in U.S. history, Senate Leader Mitch McConnell has said Republicans will refuse to allow hearings on Garland or any nominee made by President Obama for the 11 months left in his term. Judge Garland is currently the chief judge on the Court of Appeals and has a law degree from Harvard University. He is also a former Justice Department prosecutor who secured convictions in the Oklahoma City bombing case. He has tended to render conservative decisions regarding criminal defendants, but has been more liberal on civil rights and environmental regulations. Obama rejected calls from the Democratic Party's liberal wing to appoint a member of a racial minority or a judge with a strong progressive track record. Instead, he chose a jurist with impeccable legal credentials and a history of respecting the law, not engaging in judicial activism. In so doing, he no doubt hoped to dissuade Republicans from taking a nakedly political stance to block any nominee, even one they previously supported. The president, at a press conference at the White House Rose Garden, stated, "I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to his work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence." He added pointedly, "To suggest that someone as qualified and respected as Merrick Garland doesn't even deserve a hearing, let alone an up or down vote, to join an institution as important as our Supreme Court, when two-thirds of Americans believe otherwise, that would be unprecedented," the president added. Recent polls have shown that even a majority of Republicans believe that the Senate should hold a hearing for Garland. The court is currently split 4-4 on many key issues, such as women's reproductive freedoms, with the future of legalized abortion hanging in the balance. How Garland might rule on abortion is unknown, since he has not had to address the issue as a judge thus far. He did, however, vote in a unanimous decision in Priests for Life versus Health and Human Services to save the contraceptive benefits under the Affordable Care Act. The court rejected arguments brought by religious nonprofits, finding that the accommodation process to avoid complying with the Affordable Care Act's contraception benefit does not violate their religious rights. The accommodation process allows third parties to provide the contraceptive coverage for employees. Garland has a more conservative record in criminal justice stemming from his years as a prosecutor for the Justice Department in the Clinton administration, where he won the government's case against Oklahoma City bombers Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. As a judge, he also ruled that Guantanamo prisoners could be tried in a military tribunal, a ruling that was later overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. By refusing to hold hearings on Garland, Senate Republicans are playing a risky game, gambling that by delaying the decision, the next president would nominate a more conservative justice. But if Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders should win the White House, either would no doubt appoint a far more liberal justice than Garland. Moreover, their nominee might well be much younger than Garland, who is 63 years old, having an influence on shaping Supreme Court cases for many decades to come. If Donald Trump is elected, though he's a Republican, his views on some issues have been criticized by both left and right, and his criteria for choosing a justice remain an unpredictable wild card. If the Democrats win, there is a chance that the Senate Republicans could decide to approve Garland during the lame duck session before the new president takes office, though McConnell has said that will not occur. Even if Republican Ted Cruz should win the presidency, doubtless aiming to appoint an ultra-conservative justice, Democrats potentially could regain control of the Senate in the November election, giving them the power to block a conservative nominee, just as Republicans are now obstructing hearings on a moderate candidate for the high court.
We all want to know how much rain or snow has fallen in local communities and get accurate forecasts on future weather. Now you can help make that happen. The National Weather Service is looking for volunteers to gather info that will help them better predict the weather, particularly in mountain and desert areas where valuable data on precipitation is lacking. The Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, nicknamed COCORAS, is a nonprofit group of volunteer precipitation observers. They report rain, hail, and snow, as well as any significant weather as it occurs. Jimmy Tager, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in San Diego, says anyone can join and it's easy to report the data. To volunteer just takes a few minutes a day, along with a 4-inch rain gauge and internet access. To get started, go to COCORAS.org. That's spelled COCORAHS.org. The website is easy to use, has instructions on how to record your observations, and a helpful video. The site also has daily maps of observers' reports showing where precipitation has fallen. The information gathered can be very valuable for hydrologists, farmers, weather forecasters, and others. If you have questions, you can call 858-675-8700. This has been a public service announcement for the National Weather Service.
About 24 million Americans get their medical care from a community health center, yet 95% of those clinics are affected by one or more vacancies on their staff. A new report called Staffing the Safety Net says 2 million additional patients could be served if these centers could recruit enough health care providers. Dr. Ron Yee is the chief medical officer for the National Association of Community Health Centers, which issued the report. He says people with a variety of medical specialties are needed.
Most of them are for family physicians. And then after that, about 56% of health centers have openings for behavioral health staff, such as licensed clinical social workers or psychologists or other mental health or substance abuse professionals.
Lee says one reason for the shortage is that these clinics typically are located in rural, impoverished areas, so it can be hard to attract candidates. His group supports full funding for the loan repayment programs of the National Health Service Corps, more investment in teaching health centers, and reauthorizing funding for nurse practitioner residency training. Carrie Hydash, CEO of the Family Healthcare Network in Visalia, says her organization has found innovative ways to keep its staff providers.
Many people come to work for us from outside the area and eventually want to move closer to family. So in the last year, we implemented a grandparent relocation program where we'll help to move grandparents closer to the provider team versus having the provider move home.
She says the Family Healthcare Network also tries to ensure as much work-life balance as possible and has hired people to do all the coding for electronic medical records so providers can spend more time with the patients. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and today we have a special guest, Mark Hansen, who is the publisher of East County Magazine, head of and president of the Heartland Foundation. The Heartland Foundation is well known because of all their activities after the Cedar Fire and all the things they've done with our community. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Leon.
One thing that's happened with the Heartland Foundation is that you've won some major awards. Would you tell us about that?
Yes, I will. Well, we've won a number of awards, most recently awards from the state legislature and Los Angeles for our work in assisting immigrants with economic development, starting small businesses, and attending graduate school at University of California at Los Angeles and Riverside and having scholarships for them. And a lot of the funding's been raised in the L.A. community, but in Mexico has also matched that funding 3-1. And Romero Sandoval, our CFO, has spearheaded this effort, which we would like to bring down to San Diego and work with El Cajon and the populations here, the immigrant populations here.
Yeah, well, we definitely have immigrants here. So how is this program helping immigrants?
It gets some of them in schools. In San Diego, we have the Heartland Youth Build School, and they'll accept students between the ages of 16 and 24. We have funding from the California Construction Council that gets the students their tools, gets them a case manager, gets them job training, but also placement. Like the students get jobs during the holiday break in the summer from $10 to $20 an hour with the temp services in those fields in construction. We've also gotten jobs in manufacturing, healthcare, and in financial services as assistants in that industry. We have them get a full diploma. We have a trimester program at our Youth Build School. It's at 5280 Orange Avenue, not far from Crawford. But they have full diplomas. They're all state accredited through California Youth Build District. It's Youth Build of California. And it's helped a lot of those immigrants get an even setting in San Diego. They oftentimes go to City College, from there to San Diego State, and get degrees. We can also help them start small businesses in technology, maintenance, things like that. If many times they want to work for someone else first, so they get in that job mode while they're in school. They have a 3-week work readiness program that they do after school. And if they're affiliated with any of the unions, they have to attend the union trainings in the evenings at maybe Tuesday and Thursday. And to get that, they have to have the high school diploma first and then apply in the summer. And we've had a lot of wonderful partners who have assisted us with this, Urban League, San Diego Workforce Partnership. Another good development partner with Heartland is SDG&E. They gave us a grant not too long ago to train veterans in building information management.
That's wonderful.
And we conducted that out at Southwestern College. You might remember that.
Yeah, that's right.
Story for that. Uh-huh. And I know you've done a story for our Youth Build students.
What is the
makeup? And you helped them learn how to put in windows,
that's basic
skill. Right.
That's true. What is the student makeup of the Youth Build Charter School? What's it like?
They're all students who dropped out. Mostly, they didn't cross the street. Elkhorn Middle School has a lot of students who don't go across the street to Elkhorn Valley High School in the fall because of financial pressures. And we have that in City Heights, Crawford and Hoover, San Diego, Morris, Lincoln. And people are amazed what they don't have money to go to high school. No, they have to get a job because the mom with maybe 3 or 4 kids is working full time, but that can't support all the kids and the rent and the car. And generally the fathers aren't there. When I was the director of training and development at the San Diego Imperial County's Labor Council, we had an office right near Hoover. So I would be on the senior project reports and none of them had fathers. They had been disappeared in East Africa, or when they got here, different things have happened.
So the area where the school is quite a melting pot in San Diego.
Yeah, it is.
There's Somalians, there's immigrants from Chaldeans, and some of these, I understand, come over and they have an education, but they don't have a degree.
They don't have a big problem is they're an engineer in another country, but it's not recognized here. They could be a doctor in another country, and they would almost never be able to practice here because the test is really difficult. Mm. Doctors in our country don't have to pass it, but they graduate from an accredited medical school in the U.S.
Oh, I see.
So some of them think they don't want to take a menial job, so they go to the casinos where they proceed to lose their savings generally.
That does happen.
They're not experienced gamblers, so yeah. So it's been a problem. Al Sanati's worked a lot with that group with Iraq, the immigrant and refugee center.
So, what is the greatest need at the Youth Build Charter School, and what can we do to help?
We need more students. I'm talking to area high schools. If students are dropping out because They need to work during the day. We have an independent study program, but generally we like them at school all day, but we get them that support on weekends and evenings. We give them jobs so they can survive, and they still do their full course load. And so if students are interested in attending the Youth Build School, they could do that and enrolled. So they just call 619-546-9259. That's the number of the counselor, okay. Carlos McCray, and they could get enrolled right away.
You have a website too as well?
Oh, yeah. And there's a website that'd be interesting for Youth Build Charter. They could look at the whole district and all the programs. That's www.youthbuildcharter.org. And we have very small classes of 15. We have project-based education that builds technical, academic, and leadership skills. We have year-round enrollment, and we have a trimester program, which will allow them to graduate faster, which is sometimes important because then they can get those solid jobs. They hit $20-an-hour jobs as soon as they're out.
You're working on, in Otay, a location where you can do some...
Yes. We've applied with grants with the California Energy Commission, the Department of Labor, a Youth Build grant, and also the Department of Commerce. We have a good relationship with them. We won an award for Service Agency of the Year in 2012. But in this facility, we would have Green Smart Technical College at DBA of Heartland, and also four different businesses. One would assemble electric cars in bodies that were Porsche replicas. The ones, the 1965 replicas.
Speedsters.
And the coupes, things like that. And
yeah.
It's nothing that's built recently, but those were kind of romantic icons for a generation, and younger people like them too. And in it would be an electric motor, which would allow the car to go 180 mile hour range, 100 miles an hour, and you can charge it in 3 hours at your house if you have 220, 6 hours with 110, but still it would charge overnight if you slept 6 hours. Most people can do that. And it would have enough range to certainly get around San Diego County.
In a Porsche.
Yeah, in a Porsche replica. It looked
Porsche
like
replica.
The one James Dean drove for their beautifully made cars. And they have electric windows because it'd be very expensive to put the hand one. They haven't made these cars for such a long time.
Is that right?
You'd have to, make them from scratch pretty much. Jay Leno and Seinfeld have those, but they cost millions. Ours would be $30,000 to $40,000, and you would have the coupe's a little more expensive than the Speedster because of the roof. And you push a button and the sound system comes out, and the coupe would have air conditioning and have an airbag for the driver and all the dual disc brakes, rack and pinion steering, modern bells and whistles. And they have tubular construction, so they're very safe. They wouldn't be on old Volkswagen Pans, which some of the replicas used to be on. Yeah. They haven't made those since 2000 in Brazil either. So they would have, that's our everyday driver version. We would also have some race car models for the track, but, that's a different deal.
And then you're also building a structural...
insulated panels.
Right.
That's a green building material, and it's a little bit noisy. We would try to work with the Deaf Community Services to bring in workers there with disabilities. They would be perfect in there because you
need interesting.
To communicate with sign language anyway. That area
right.
would be a little noisy. And then we'd have advanced manufacturing equipment from the... if we can get that other grant, and that would help with both of those models. We also have one that would produce instant mobile houses, and
yes.
they're just beautiful. It's on instantmobilehouse.com. This one has a VIN number on it. You can drive it right up. It's for aging in place for college students, and it's approved. And it's produced by Mark Anderson. He's the son of Rex Anderson with Anderson Drilling. He has a lot of inventions of his own. He has a jig that will turn a house over just the way jigs turn cars over to develop and finish them. And
really?
They're two-story places. He has a show lot on Anza in Maine, if you drive by, but they're just gorgeous inside, and people would be very happy in them all built in.
So they're produced. All self-contained. They got power and
everything.
Solar, water.
And you can hook into sewer. They're proof of that. Now they're made in Phoenix. But we would move that into San Diego County, and the city of San Diego can give us huge tax credits because that Otay Mesa, of course, was built with the assumption the Maquiladora plan was going to work well.
Right.
Did not happen.
Didn't happen.
We have a lot of space there, and we can get foreign trade credits. It's 3 miles from the Mexican border. It's close to the Lindbergh Field, and people from China are also interested in that area because they're trying to put funding in America. So they would want to have a showcase there for LED lighting. Mm. And we have a wind turbine that's been donated to us. It's a vertical axis one. It'd be safe for the birds, and a small one. And we have a donated one now that we can use as a demonstration model. You've seen that one.
You're going to assemble these vertical axes.
We would assemble them, and they'll save a lot of money on that. They'll be assembled in this country. And we'll also manufacture some of the parts, even though it was designed originally in Japan. Yeah. And the model we have was the same one that was down at Harbor Island for a year, and then they lost a permit. So we have that at a Heartland partnership site now.
Well, that's wonderful. Sounds like you're doing a lot of workforce development,
creating
jobs. And that's what Heartland's been doing all along.
Since 1998, we've had 18 incubator companies. Most of them, 17 of them, have worked very well. What we might do, too, we're going to have some financial strategy courses and seminars that we'll have probably at North County location, and we're going to have some sponsorship there. And I also work for the Principal Financial Group, so we'll look to help small businesses get started and avoid pitfalls, and we'll have little presentations like how to launch your dream business without going broke, how to match the risk you're taking with your age, the legal foundations of the business, and getting everything covered so you don't run into these big disasters that many small businesses do. We'd look at the healthcare requirements, the importance of putting, if you have employees, setting up that trust account and guarding that. Since 2013, that's a felony if that gets behind. And remembering their retirement, too. We'll do all that to help more small businesses be successful. Right now, about 1 in 10 goes under, and some of them disastrously under, because it wipes out not only the business, but the principals who try to protect it. And it's something that can be avoided, but you have to eliminate the financial risk, the moral risk, and the morale risk. Build a good morale and a good ethos in the small business from the start.
Well, that's wonderful. I can see how a lot of the immigrants perhaps would find it easier to start a business than it would be to try to, you know, get the kind of accreditations and certifications and diplomas that they need.
They do. A basic diploma that's still important, if they can do that, is a bachelor's. And that's important for getting grants, somebody in it. But if they're graduating at age 24 from high school, by the time they get that, they'll be close to 30. But if they could work part-time and still do that, if they decide they do want to go into the world of work, that has become a bottom line barrier. Even though the job might not require any degree at all. Mm-hmm. And if they get those, it should be from a solid school. Mm-hmm. And that's why we send the students to San Diego State. The tuition's not too high. Nobody questions the validity of the education. Right. They certainly don't want to get a degree just to get a degree from a school no one's ever heard of that's not accredited, and that would just be a waste of money, unless they learned valuable skills there. Because mostly it's what you learn how to do. It's not just the piece of paper. Right. There still is that barrier if they're going to work for someone else that exists now more than ever. So there's so many college graduates who are unable to get jobs but are very capable, but that's an easy thing for employers to do, see if they have a degree.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you'd like to...
We are maybe going to get into some real estate again in San Diego. Right now, we're doing First Look programs in Los Angeles and Riverside.
The First Look, by the way,
That's an old program. It was from NSP, the National Stabilization Program from the federal government, that NSP 1, 2, and 3, but that is now disappeared, but some of the cities still have some residual program from the first look.
So basically, they're an eyesore home in a neighborhood, maybe run down and maybe in foreclosure. And the nonprofit gets the first look, right?
Yeah. What's happening in L.A. is people from China are buying these houses just on Google. They want to put money in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So they buy the house, and it sits there.
Mm.
And California isn't real vicious about that. Like Chicago, you really wouldn't want to do that. You get a fine if the lawn's too high. It's an attorney state. You have to send an attorney to court. But in California, well, first of all, we don't have the heavy rains, humidity. The lawn doesn't grow 6 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
But the cities are a little friendlier.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're trying to do, the cities will fund if the house can be sold to a veteran, somebody lower moderate income.
First-time home buyer, maybe.
Home buyer.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming back a little bit, but a lot fewer properties because there aren't those big discounts anymore. But what they would be able to do is maybe give a first-time home buyer or a veteran a $50,000 reduction in price to encourage those people in the community to buy the houses, and hopefully they are going to coach a little league team and be a member of the community and be on the PTA. And
so you're still working with Urban League?
Not the Urban Corps, but the Job Corps.
Job Corps, sorry. Yeah. You know, I just noticed they were in the news recently. Uh-huh. They'd gotten some grant.
They're down in San Ysidro. And
yeah, that's
we
right.
worked with them. You did.
That's
they gave
right.
you an
that's
award,
right.
you might remember.
That's right. That's right.
And so
I like the kids that came out of there. They were hard workers.
We have program banks have offered us. We're in these things to get free houses in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like free houses in Fresno or Chicago or Miami or especially New Orleans. What happens is it's one house maybe every other year. But another very good group, Community Housing Works, has always had the first look at that. And so if it's anything that we could work with, it'll pretty much be gone. What we're looking to do is replicate what we're doing in L.A. and Riverside in San Diego, where the house in here, you're lucky to get the houses at cost. You sometimes have to pay more than fair market value.
Mm-hmm.
And that obliterates any chance to train students, which takes longer. And you worked on that
right.
Hell's Mountain project. So that took maybe 4 months because we were training folks. If we hired the most expensive six guys in town, it would have been done in 18 days. But
right.
we didn't want to do that. We wanted the training and the
right.
opportunity for the students. So the person financing was a Heartland Advisory Board member, and he didn't mind doing that. They have to understand. And it was a beautiful house, and like, you know, green features to it. But yeah, it's not a model that is fiscally sustainable, but you can do it every once in a while. So we're
right.
applying for grants. The Youth Build grant would allow us to build three houses in Spring Valley on three lots there that were donated to Heartland. And those three houses would be, we could sell, we'd do one a year and sell it. And they would not, it would be an instant mobile house, but there would also be a stick build, a workshop attached to a carport. So they have the stick build experience, which Youth Build USA likes them to have.
Good.
So that's in the works, and that grant will be submitted in June.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you here, Mark.
Thank you.
As always, and give us an update on what Heartland Foundation is up to. And we wish you the best of luck.
We're doing that, and we also have a Mute Valley Mutual Water Company now. But
that's right.
That could be
that's
for
right.
another segment.
It could be. I always wondered, how does a person start a water district?
Yeah,
and you guys have done that.
We know that now, and that's got incubator company of Heartland Coalition to address what happens in a drought when people are on wells. So there's strategies for that.
Well, we'll get back together on that one because I think it's a whole separate story on how the water goes. Thank you again.
Thank you, Leon. Take care.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, guest hosting the Sounds of History, recording on the road today in Ramona. We are at the Guy B. Woodward Museum in Ramona, which is a marvelous place, and it is my great pleasure today to introduce our special guest, Ken Woodward, who is the curator of the museum. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Now, I understand that your own family has long roots in Ramona. Tell us a little bit about your own family history first, and then we'll talk about the museum.
Yes, my family came out of Kellogg, Iowa. They came to Ramona in 1896, and the whole family, aunts, uncles, grandfather, grandmother, kids, girlfriends, the whole group. Two of them, they were actually farmers and dairymen out of Kellogg, Iowa.
And so what brought them to California, and how did they get here?
Well, they had lived in Iowa for many, many years, and they were just simply getting tired of the harsh winters and trying to take care of their farms and cattle. And so the whole family just packed up and came westward. That was my great-grandfather and all of his brothers and sisters.
Now, I understand that your family has quite the history here in Ramona. Can you give us a couple of highlights?
Yes, my family, they were farmers and dairymen, and later my dad and his six brothers and sisters became very attached to Ramona. They grew up here. My dad's brother became a very famous historical archaeologist and historian, and my dad moved on in the 1930s and became chief of police in Oceanside, where he finished his years.
Now, let's hear about the museum.
The primary purpose of the museum was to commemorate the old-timers in Ramona, and they came here, they began coming here in about 1870.
Now, Ken, I understand that when your father was putting this whole marvelous museum together with all these different buildings, that he got some help from somebody who had a lot of experience in stage set design. Tell us about that.
Yes, he was very fortunate. Mr. Bill Cowan had moved to Ramona, and he had retired, and Bill Cowan was actually worked for Walt Disney Studios, and he built sets and built towns for Walt Disney Studios. So when my dad got ready to begin building some of the old barns and everything, he was very glad to help.
Yeah, this really does look like you've been plopped down and reincarnated in the middle of the Old West here with all these wonderful buildings. The centerpiece of it is the Theophile Verlaki House.
Yes.
And that was built, I understand, in 1886.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the house and how it came to be built.
Yes. Theophile Verlaki, he was a Basque from southern France. And at the time he left France in 1870 to come to the New World, to make his living. The whole Verlaki family came in to New Orleans, and then he found his way in 1870 to San Diego. And he became very prominent in San Diego. He built several businesses there, became one of the largest wine producers in San Diego.
Wow, so Ramona's wine industry has roots that go all the way back to the 1800s. Very interesting. And today it's certainly a thriving business up here. What can people see if they go into the Verlaki house today?
Well, I always tell people that they need to understand that everything they see here on this property has all been donated, mainly because the museum is a nonprofit organization. And when they go into that beautiful home, and it is all adobe, and they will find it beautifully furnished with all donated furniture, with all kinds of books in the library, with all kinds of furnishings in throughout.
And there's also a doctor's office. Tell us about that.
And there's a really interesting doctor's office. One of the bedrooms has been converted into a doctor's office. And that is, we have very old medical equipment that actually goes back to the 1800s that doctors have been donating to the museum. And it's really fascinating to see these old pieces of equipment.
There's also some very ornate furnishings. There's a fabulous antique grand piano in there, an old pump organ, a Victrola. And in one of the back bedrooms, I understand there's a bedroom set with an interesting history, too, very ornate.
Yes, the bedroom set is brought in to the museum in 1980. And this lady came in and said, I'd like to donate this beautiful bedroom set. It was built in 1840 back in Connecticut. But she said, you need to know who I am. She said, first of all, I'm part of the Yale family, the producers of the Yale Lock Company, And my great-great-grandfather in 1840 was the person who put together the Yale Law Company.
Now, there's a lot more than just a vintage home on this property, however. You have amassed an amazing collection of some of the original buildings here in Ramona. Folks, if you come out here to the museum, the Guy B. Woodward Museum, you can see a vintage schoolhouse, a blacksmith shop, a barn, buggies, all kinds of interesting buildings, covered wagon, and also a jail. Now, I understand there's a really colorful history behind that jail. Tell us about it.
The jail was actually built in San Diego about 1890, and the jail was brought up here, 7 tons of iron, brought up to Ramona, and installed as the Ramona Jail. And then in the 1930s, it disappeared. And
so the jail was stolen?
No. The county of San Diego started using it for a dynamite storage, and it was found in a canyon and brought back to the museum.
Now, I understand that your mother used to have a job related to the jail.
Actually, that was my grandmother back in the late 1800s. Her job was to feed the prisoners, and she got 15 cents a day to bring them broth in.
And it has now been restored and brought back here to Ramona, and you can see it if you come out to visit the Guy B. Woodward Museum. There's some other interesting buildings here. We're doing the interview actually sitting here in an old barn. What's the history of this?
Actually, it was one of my dad's ideas to bring in all of the old barns and all the old buildings that he could to the museum property. This barn was built in 1870. It was built by the Barnett family who came in to Ramona from San Francisco area.
Looks like it's set up for meetings. Do you hold different kinds of meetings or events in here nowadays?
Yes. Every other month we have a potluck, and people are simply invited to bring something that they can share with everyone else. And we come in here and we have speakers on history and Ramona and things of this nature. It's really very good.
What fun. That's just an amazing resource to find. This place is a veritable treasure trove. As you walk through, you see antique dolls and vintage clothing and furnishings and tools. And there was a very interesting giant cook pot out there. Tell us about that.
The cook pot actually belonged to the Ortega family. And the Ortega family came to the valley in 1843. And they actually owned all 17,000 acres here in the valley.
So this was the family that received the land through the original Spanish land grant.
That's correct. And so the Ortegas proceeded to use the valley for farming all kinds of wheat and everything.
Now, of course, long before the original settlers came here, we had the Native Americans, the Kumeyaay people. I understand you have some Native American artifacts that people can see here as well.
Yes, the Kumeyaay Indians came to the valley 2,000 years ago, and we have some beautiful Indian artifacts, a whole display in the basement from that tribe.
Wow, I would love to take a look at that. And I understand, by the way, that the Kumeyaay now say they trace their history in the San Diego region back 10 to 12,000 years. Interesting, they've recently found some artifacts in some other areas that suggest they may have been here even a lot longer than that. There are also a lot of interesting vehicles here. I see some vintage buggies, you know, like horse-drawn buggies, and what looks like a Conestoga wagon or covered wagon out there.
Yes. The one large wagon that we have, it seats about 12 people, and it used to take all the people that came into Lakeside into Julian. It took 12 hours for that wagon to take 12 people from Lakeside to Julian.
My goodness, how times have changed. And the kids think they have it rough now. Now, when your father was first getting started and putting this all together, there was another benefactor from San Diego who came along. He was the owner of San Diego Trust and Savings. Can you give us some details?
Yes, Mr. Thomas W. Sefton stopped by to see my dad one time and introduced himself, and my dad took him all the way through the museum and told him what he intended to do, and Mr. Sefton said, "Guy, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to donate my mining equipment to the museum," which he did later on.
Yeah, and your father started this back in the 1980s or so, and then I understand that after he passed on and after Mr. Sefton passed on, the mantle kind of fell to you and you came along and went downtown to retrieve all the mining equipment.
Yes, we were very fortunate because the Sefton family gave me a call one day and they said, Ken, I understand that our father promised to give you all of the mining equipment from the Colorado, California, Nevada gold mines. And I said, yes, he did. And they said, well, come down and get it.
What else did you find when you went down there?
First of all, they directed me to a warehouse next on Marina Boulevard, right next to the train tracks. And so I went down, knocked on the door, took a look, and the train tracks actually came into this large barn area, and Mr. Sefton's own personal railroad car was there.
What those very wealthy travelers used to use to go cross-country in the olden days. Now, he also donated some other interesting things. I see a tall ship replica down here. What else?
Well, in addition to the ship replica, it's difficult to believe, but he also donated the keys to Mount Vernon, George Washington's house. And that has always been a very interesting display.
Well, there you go. That's amazing. What else can people see that you would like people to know about the museum and the facilities here?
Well, the way the museum is put together, I think, is the most important, because all of a sudden the centerpiece is the Verlac House, built in 1886. You have a full-size basement, which is filled with beautiful artifacts. Then we have adorned on, my dad had brought in all of these buildings from the 1870s, and he reconstructed them here on the property. We're sitting in an old barn that was built in 1870.
It's amazing. It's really one of those little-known treasures we have out here in East County that I think a lot of people don't know about and would love to visit if they could. Now, speaking of visiting, when is the museum open to the public?
The museum is open to the public as advertised Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 1 to 4 o'clock. However, the museum is also open Monday through Thursday. We have one of our workers here, and they will open up the museum to anyone that desires to come in during the week.
Well, that's a good tip for our listeners here at East County Magazine. I know it's run by a nonprofit organization. So if people have maybe old artifacts out there from the Ramona area in their basements or attics, who would they get in touch with if they have something they may wish to donate?
They would get in touch with our main office here on the grounds and describe what they would like to donate to see if we can use it and see if it fits in. And that has been done. You'll be surprised at the number of artifacts that we have here that are local to Ramona.
Wonderful. So if you want to visit the museum, you can visit their website at www.woodwardmuseum.org. Ken, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I'm going to give you the last word here. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about the Woodward Museum or the history of Ramona?
Well, I think it's really interesting. We have people from all over the world going through this museum. People coming in to visit California, they hear about the museum, they come up and they get a wonderful trip through the museum.
And it's located right on Main Street here in the heart of downtown Ramona today. Ken, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you very much, and it's been a delight talking to you.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.